And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. We're back with plenty to do over the next few hours. With you till 3 on this Tuesday with plenty to do throughout the afternoon. Coming up, biggest takeaways from the NBA playoffs so far. Plus, college football making a smart decision. And which team in the SEC is ready to take a big step forward. Also, we had quite a big upset over the weekend. Where does it rank amongst the biggest sports upsets we've had? And what could it mean for college football moving forward? We'll get to our Tuesday top 10. I got plenty of travel stories to speak of. Get to Trent's takes later on and a whole lot more throughout the afternoon. Oh, and F1 Racing taking over Southern Florida. We're going to touch on some things that we usually don't spend a whole lot of time on. But there are big stories over the weekend. Wasn't here yesterday, wasn't here the last couple of days. Good to be back with plenty to do between now and 3 on a Tuesday. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, on Facebook at ESPN Charleston, via email studio at kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just head over there and click on our show page where you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Wait there till 3. Trent's on the steel wheels. Trent, what's going on? How are you?
Luke, I'm doing well, sir. Glad to have you back here in the studio. I've been missing you. Hope you had a good trip. I'm doing all right. You know, had a good time last night celebrating the 21st birthday. It was a good time. And back on the saddle, ready to roll, Luke. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, that's a big day. Big day for you.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, all right. I guess so.
Now it's all downhill from here. I guess the next big one you look forward to when you reach a certain age where you can rent a car without any sort of issues. And then after that, then it's nothing. Then you have nothing to look forward to other than old age. In fact, I found out, so I was out of town the last couple of days, and even though it was Mother's Day weekend, it was not to go home and spend time with my mother. My buddies and I from all over the country got together, spent a weekend somewhere, and you realize that maybe some of us, not so much me, everyone else, not aging as gracefully, right? People falling asleep on the couch, you're sore in the morning. It's like, oh my goodness, we got old fast. You can't have as fun of a time as you're used to. You can't handle it as well, and it hits you quickly. So anyone who's obviously has grown up, it can hit you quick. Now, with that said, I'm looking forward to getting back out there and playing a little basketball tomorrow. Good to be back. Speaking of basketball, let me start with this, with the NBA playoffs. Let's recap the 5 biggest stories. We have 4 series and an MVP award. I've been gone for a few days. We've had a bunch of games go on. 3 of the 4 series are tied at 2. So let's turn it into a tasty top 5. We'll run through the 5 big stories in the NBA right now. I'll give you my biggest takeaway from where we are right now in the NBA postseason.
This is a tasty burger.
It's the tasty top 5.
I'm tasty.
Number 5.
In no particular order, let's go Miami-Philadelphia in the series in the East, tied at 2. What a difference Joel Embiid makes when he returned and Philadelphia won the last 2 games with him, playing with that face mask. And James Harden, finally, looking like the James Harden of old last time out. Now, the question becomes, what should you expect tonight? I don't think it's as good of a performance for James Harden. I would bet the under for James Harden. After what happened the other day, and now going on the road, big game 5, I think the Heat are a better team, especially at home. But to finally see that from James Harden, And it wasn't just the output. He scored over 30 points. He actually made his shots. He looked energized. But it was the passion. And I talked about this on the show last week before I went out of town for a few days. It just seemed like Harden hasn't really cared, which was my same complaint this year specifically about Kevin Durant. And for the first time, Harden actually looked like he cared. He was animated. And even back in his prime, you know, just a couple years ago, he was never that animated on the floor. He was always cool, calm, collective, with that big beard, hiding any sort of emotion for the most part. But the other night, right, he was fired up. He was into it. Making big plays, stoking the fire, getting the crowd excited, celebrating after big baskets. He was into it. And he looked like the James Harden of old for the first time since arriving in Philadelphia. It was the first time he scored over 25 points in a playoff game in, I think it was like 13 playoff games. It had been a while. He played really well, and he helped lead them to a big victory to even that series. Now the follow-up becomes, well, what should we expect from him tonight? What's the encore? Now that James Harden has done that, it becomes almost like the expectation. You know it's in there. Maybe not every night, but he still has the capabilities of playing a lot better than he has since arriving in Philadelphia. It's like when you get flowers for your significant other, maybe early on in a relationship, or for your mother or grandmother or whoever it may be. That becomes the expectation. Even if you only do it once, they know you have it in you to be able to purchase flowers for them for their birthday, for a holiday, or just a random weekend. Now you're kind of expected to do it moving forward. For James Harden, he showed, like, yeah, you know what? He still has some of these capabilities. Maybe not every game, but he can step up in a big spot. Let's see how he follows it up, though, these next couple of games. Miami going home is a big difference. We saw that in all these series. Dallas looked like a much different team at home. Philadelphia looked much different at home. Obviously, Joel Embiid comes back. That helps. So if you're a Miami, if you're a Phoenix, if you're a Boston, you're tied right now, but it becomes a three-game series, and you have home court advantage. You're home for two of the next three. Just win at home. You'll be fine. We've seen throughout these playoffs that the home teams have played better. Home court advantage has been a big deal. And for Philadelphia, Joel Embiid's return has been the big story, and James Harden finally looking like the Harden of old. The other series in the East, Milwaukee and Boston, call this story number four. They're now tied at two. And Boston with a huge win last night, that was their season. And it was Al Horford stepping up. Horford set the record for the most playoff games before having a 30-point playoff game in NBA history. That was his 152nd playoff game, finally went off for 30. The concern with Boston is exactly what I was talking about at the beginning of the postseason. Jason Tatum is a star. Is he a superstar? And he looked like a superstar throughout that series against Brooklyn. But then this round, especially these last two games, it's kind of disappeared. He was terrible in Game 3, and the Celtics coughed up a big, what would have been, a big win. And while he started off strong in Game 4, disappeared in the second half, and it was Al Horford going for 30 points to lead the way. Al Horford, who's been in the league for 20 years and who was a salary dump. And the Celtics brought him in because of his familiarity. He likes Brad Stevens. They've had him before. It was a good fit. Not really anyone else was interested. And certainly he rewarded them in a big spot yesterday, evening up that series and keeping the Celtics season alive. You fall behind 3-1. I don't care if you're going home. That's a lot to overcome. Now you even up the series 2-2. And you're home for two of the next three, and the Celtics are back in the catbird seat against the defending champs. A lot of times that's what it takes to be a champion, though, right? You need somebody else to step up. Jason Tatum hasn't been playing his best. Don't worry, Al Horford's here to save the day. Here are the guys on Get Up this morning, Tim Legler, J.J. Redick, and Mike Greenberg, talking about the Celtics now that they've evened the series, not only how they've gotten to this point against Milwaukee, but also that maybe they still are the team to beat in the NBA playoffs.
If you're Mike Budenholzer right now, you're saying, how was I supposed to account for how Al Horford is playing offensively in this series? That's really what it comes down to for him. He thinks, okay, I checked all these boxes. I did a pretty good job and everything. And then I've got this unaccounted for guy that's going off that's just absolutely killing me. And I think there's going to obviously have to be some sort of an adjustment there, because I think now Milwaukee could possibly get a road win if Al Horford just has a regular night.
And the stat that was on the screen a moment ago, and I apologize, Beyond, I was supposed to get to it more quickly, and I freelanced away from it. And that's but our odds makers, I told you Caesars likes the Warriors. Our analytics like the Celtics. They list the Celtics right now as the likeliest team to win the NBA championship. And I felt at the beginning of our program today like you were leaning that way as well.
I'm leaning that way as well. ESPN, BPI, or whatever it's called.
Yes, the BPI.
They've loved the Celtics
the
for like 2 months. They've loved
index.
The Celtics for 2 months,
yes.
To be honest with you. And on the Horford adjustment, look, Milwaukee plays a certain way, and they're going to be in drop coverage, and so you're always closing back out to Al Horford. He killed them last night in pick and pop. So the adjustment to me is at some point, you're going to have to switch Giannis onto the ball handler, and you've got enough size and strength to switch your guards onto Al Horford and make it tough that way. They've got to mix up their coverage with him.
That was Reddick, Tim Legler, Mike Greenberg breaking it down this morning about what the Bucks have to do moving forward and if the Celtics are still the team to beat. Not a conversation, though, if you lose that game yesterday. And because of Al Horford, they were able to even the series. Now you head home, no Chris Middleton, and the Celtics are home for two of the next three. On to story number three, we shift over to the West, where you have Phoenix and Dallas. And the Mavericks look like a much different team at home. When they were in Phoenix for those first two games, the Suns just took advantage of Luka Doncic's inability to defend. Or the fact that Luka has to do so much that he tires down by the second half, especially on the defensive end of the floor. And they just got him in pick-and-roll situations, and they scored on, I believe it was 72% of those plays. They just shredded Dallas. A little bit different when the series shifted to Dallas. And Doncic still played well. They were better defensively. And Chris Paul did not play well whatsoever in Game 4. Now, there was the off-the-court issue with his family. Maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe that distracted him, got into his head. He obviously had foul trouble, where some of the calls were questionable. Some of the other calls were just kind of silly for Chris Paul to put himself in that situation. And without Chris Paul available and Dallas having their best ever shooting performance, they evened up the series over the weekend. Now it's tied at two heading back to Phoenix. Here's the thing about Chris Paul. Right, he's never won a championship before. And the knock on him, not only the fact that he hasn't won, but it's that his teams usually cough up series. So you're up 2-0, you go to Dallas, series evens, and you play terribly in Game 4 while your team kind of gets run out of the gym and you're on the bench with foul trouble and eventually foul out. You hardly play in the game, you had as many fouls as points. Now you go back to Phoenix. Just say Dallas wins Game 5 and they take a 3-2 lead. Not only does the pressure, obviously, ramp up for Phoenix, they'd be heading on the road trailing 3-2 in the series, but most specifically Chris Paul, because he played so poorly in Game 4, just like these other series I was just discussing. That is a huge game. Milwaukee goes up 3-1. That's obviously a huge difference between 2-2. Phoenix, you go up 3-1 against Dallas going home. It's a huge difference than now an even series 2-2. And because Chris Paul played so terribly in Game 4, and then you have the ordeal off the court as well, and he's threatening fans, which we could get into that whole debate, who's wrong, who's right. Regardless, may not be a great look for a player who's not having a good playoff game. It's a whole weird situation anyways. But now, heading back 2-2, not only is the pressure on Phoenix, but specifically Chris Paul. Let's go back to the Tim Legler well. This is what Legler had to say about Chris Paul's performance in Game 4 and what he would expect in Game 5 tonight.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain because you're looking at the combination of factors that led to Chris Paul not being included in that game. Some his own doing, some just not smart plays when you're already not getting benefit of the doubt on calls earlier. There was also a couple, he's just wrong place, wrong time. And then I thought there was a couple other ones that I just absolutely disagreed with the call. Any way you slice it, when you're in that kind of foul trouble the entire game, there's no way you can get into rhythm on the other end of the floor. I just thought it was a very strange game for Chris Paul. Even the lack of emotion that he showed after these calls. Like, at no point did he even react to anything. So I don't know what was going on with him and with his emotions, but I know this. Chris Paul knows the pressure's on him. People are watching him. He is going to have a huge bounce back game, I believe, in Game 5 in Phoenix.
He certainly will need it, as will the Suns. Story number two as we count down the Tasty Top 5, five biggest stories in the NBA right now after a couple of days out of town. Golden State and Memphis. The Warriors take a 3-1 lead in the series last night and essentially put the series away. Not having Ja Morant is huge for Memphis, even though they've played well without Ja this year, and they hung in there last night. They led for the entirety of the game until about the final 2 minutes. And Golden State found a way to win. In fact, Steph Curry went for 19 in the fourth quarter, second most points in a fourth quarter in a playoff game in his career. That's how big of a performance that was from Curry, who, entering the fourth quarter, didn't play very well. Nor did the Warriors. They missed their first 15 threes. Memphis jumped out to an early lead. And the story, or the lesson, for both Memphis and Milwaukee is that when you have a chance to put a team away, you have to do it. It's one of the most common cliches I remember from my playing days as just a kid growing up playing basketball. And that whenever you let a team hang around, it always comes back to bite you. You got to go for the jugular. And Milwaukee failed to do so, and Boston ended up pulling away in the fourth quarter and winning. Memphis failed to do so, and Golden State found a way to come back and win, led by Steph Curry. Draymond Green had a big block on the defensive end. And it may have been different if you had Ja Morant, if you had your closer available in that fourth quarter for Memphis.
But Golden State, this was the big issue going into the series that was my concern. We saw it in game one. We saw it last night. The experience of the Warriors, that even without their head coach last night, they found a way to get it done. They did not play well whatsoever. But they played better in the fourth quarter, and they went on a run late to turn it around, get a win, and essentially put the series away 3-1. They take a 3-1 series lead. It's going to be hard for Memphis to try to win the next three. But that's the difference. Memphis was leading for all but like the last 2 minutes, and yet in the end, with the experience that Golden State has and the youthfulness that Memphis has, without their star player as well, Golden State was able to find a way to win that game without playing their best. Also looked like they kind of took things easy early on without Ja Morant, maybe taking Memphis a little light, figuring, we could just flip a switch late in the game. And fortunately, they were able to do so. But that's the big difference between these two teams. Golden State has the experience, the championship DNA. They've been there before. They know what it takes. They can turn it on late, and for Memphis, they can let some of these leads slip away. If you're a Grizzly fan, and I don't know how many there are, but you feel terrible in that you've coughed up a couple of games in the series, and then even last night you're thinking, with Ja Morant, right, that's a different outcome. And while you're down 3-1, you make a layup in game one. Maybe you have Ja Morant last night. I mean, this could be Memphis up 3-1 right now. Instead, they're on the brink of elimination. They've skipped steps. They're here maybe a little earlier than they're supposed to, but still you feel the frustration of, man, this could be a much different series if just a couple things, you know, two plays went a different way. Instead, Memphis down 3-1, Golden State set to close out this series, and the Warriors looking like they may be the best team of the West. That Milwaukee-Boston series, by the way, may be the Eastern Conference Finals. Whoever comes out of that series may win the East, may both be better than what we have in Miami and Philadelphia. And then lastly, on our five biggest stories of the NBA playoffs over recent days, it's not even so much about the playoffs as it is the award, and that's the MVP, which was leaked or announced yesterday. It'll be official next week, but Jokic wins the MVP for the second straight year. And a lot of people are freaking out, saying, right, he has more MVPs than Kobe Bryant. This award is meaningless. I'm not going to compare different players in different years, but I do think Jokic was deserving of the MVP. He was my MVP throughout this year. And it was a really interesting race between Embiid and Jokic and Giannis. But to me, Jokic was the most impressive. He had the less help around him. He put up incredible numbers. He's done things we haven't seen before. He had better numbers this year than last year when he won the MVP. So theoretically, if last year was good enough to be an MVP and he was even better this year, shouldn't he just be the MVP once again? And he gets the award despite sitting at home right now and Embiid and Giannis still playing in the playoffs. But remember, the regular season award. Here is Stephen A. Smith giving his take this morning on First Take about Embiid and Giannis missing out to Jokic as Jokic wins the MVP award for the second straight year.
Yes, I disagree with it.
Okay.
Because I voted for Embiid. But I have no problem with Jokic being it. I mean, what the brother average? I got it right here, Jay. 27-13-8 without Jamal Murray, without Michael Porter Jr., knowing that you're the reigning league MVP and everybody's game planning for you on a night-in, night-out basis, I voted for Embiid. Mm-hmm. I thought the level of adversity that Jokic went through without having those two players, as significant as that was, is an entirely different animal with the nonsense that Joel Embiid was subjected to because of the whole drama that involved Ben Simmons. Yet, he held it down. He did what he did. James Harden arrived. He still did what he did. And I think that when you've seen the greatness from a Joel Embiid the way that we have this year, I was just of the mindset that he deserved a league MVP. But I can't sneeze at Jokic because it was a nip-and-tuck race. It was very close, JJ. I really, really can't have a problem with that.
Yeah, it was really close. Any of the three guys could have won it. I think they made the right call with Jokic, winning back-to-back MVPs. Now, part of the issue is, hey, he's sitting at home. The other two teams, right, Joel Embiid, you just saw his impact. Came back from that injury, playing with a face mask, all sorts of injuries. He helped the Sixers even up the series. Giannis, without Chris Middleton, right now is in a tied series in the second round with the Celtics. Meanwhile, Jokic is at home, and his team won one game in the playoff. Problem is, this is a regular season award, and it's something I've complained about in the past. I don't know why the NBA waits so long to announce these awards because it makes it look worse. Remember, there was a couple of years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, the Raptors head coach was the coach of the year. But by the time they announced the award, he had already been fired by the Raptors. It just makes for these awkward exchanges of these trophies. Do it right at the end of the regular season, before the playoffs even begin. Announce it like the very next day or 2 days later, however long it takes to get these votes in and tally it up. A couple years ago, Dwayne Casey was the coach of the year. He was already unemployed by then. Now Jokic gets the MVP. It makes things look worse when he's sitting at home. These other guys are playing, but it's not about the postseason. The votes have already been in for a while. The award was already selected. It just hasn't been announced yet. Jokic is deserving. He played with much less help around him. Giannis is on a championship roster. Embiid had Harden for half a year. Jokic had nothing. His two best teammates were injured all season, and yet he had just three fewer wins than Milwaukee or Philadelphia. Don't use the playoffs as an example of trying to determine value. Jokic was just as valuable, if not more, than those other two guys to his team, and he also just put up ridiculous numbers this year. I thought Jokic was deserving of the MVP award. And maybe the most fascinating part of the whole story, remember when Jokic was drafted, I mean, nobody knew who he was. You could go look up the pictures of when he was a kid and was kind of goofy and overweight. But when he was drafted, it was so insignificant that they were in a commercial break. He got drafted during a Taco Bell commercial, taken in the second round, and now he's a two-time MVP. Pretty good for Jokic. It's a great story. Same with Embiid and Giannis, right? All three international players coming from tough beginnings, turning themselves into these great ball players. But Embiid was a little bit more of a star coming out of college. Giannis, not as much. Giannis is in the Jokic camp that they really turned themselves into a star when nobody was anticipating it. But it's a great story. A guy who, when he was drafted, nobody cared about. They'd rather show you a Taco Bell commercial than the selection. And now he's a two-time MVP. And I think deservingly so. Coming up, the NCAA, or college football specifically, whoever's making the decisions, finally made a wise one when it comes to college football. Plus, which team in the SEC is ready to take a big step forward? More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, the NCAA made a wise move for college football. And which team's ready to step up in the SEC? The Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Open the show talking about the five biggest stories in the NBA right now. The four playoff series left and the MVP award, which is going to Nikola Jokic for the second straight year. So last night, you know, it's one of those things that nobody cares about your fantasy team. Or even like your workout routine. Or, let's be honest, most people also don't really care to see the constant photos of your kids either. You've seen one, you've seen them all. They're not your kids, you don't really care. Right, you care about your kids, you don't really care about someone else's seeing the photos at work all the time. Let's be frank about it, right? Also, same idea for, like, probably bets as well. But last night, I had the Warriors alternate spread as a 3.5-point favorite, and Steph Curry to go over 25 points as a parlay. Curry was scuffling, and I thought, oh, boy, this is dead in the water. He got over those 25 points with ease in the fourth quarter. And the Warriors, losing the whole game, came back to take a lead. And we're up by, must have been, what, six? And Wiggins is at the free throw line with one foul shot left to go up seven and to lock it in, and he misses the foul shot. And then Memphis hits a half-court three at the buzzer that was completely meaningless to lose by only three. And I had 3.5. And kids, let it be a PSA. That's why you don't gamble. What a bad beat. Send it to Scott Van Pelt last night. It was brutal. They had that locked up. And Memphis chucks up a half-court shot at the buzzer, banks it in, and they cover the 3.5 that I had on the alternate spread.
That's brutal. The worst when it's on a buzzer beater. And especially when you don't need to shoot it, game's over. Like you don't have to do it, and then they shoot it, and, I mean, your whole night's ruined after that.
Ah, terrible. And if you're Wiggins, can you make a foul shot? Oh, you make that second foul shot, it doesn't matter.
Make the gamblers happy, Wiggins.
Seriously.
What are we doing?
Jeez. Brutal. The NCAA made a smart decision in that they are moving forward, opening the door for these different conferences to remove divisions. Now, this is something we've been saying on the Morrow Midday Show for years. Divisions are pointless. And I think back to, again, it's ridiculous to try to compare fantasy football to real football. But if you're in a fantasy football league that also still has divisions, get rid of the commissioner. I remember having this conversation with other people in the last couple of years. Divisions are pointless. And in fantasy football, right, you take like the best team here and they only play the teams in your division. It makes no difference. Same with these divisions in college football. In the NFL, very important. But in college football, you don't need the divisions. And then it leads to a conference championship where you're not actually taking the two best teams. You're just taking two teams from different divisions. But use the SEC as an example. The West division is so much better than the East. If you take away Georgia, none of those teams deserve to be in a conference championship. And in the West, you had three teams in the top 20 just last year alone. And that was while Texas A&M, LSU, and Auburn all had down years. And if you go by conference, you know, by conference, you'll see that the conference championships have all come from the same divisions. Certain divisions have dominated all of these conferences. Clemson, for the longest time, obviously, was just dominating. The champion was coming out of the same division. In the SEC, for the most part, Georgia in the East has been the staple, but Alabama in the West. If you go back and look at the Big Ten, same idea. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but if you look it up, you'll see that over the past decade, the same divisions have dominated all these conferences. The divisions are meaningless, even down to the schedule. I've also always complained that you should play teams on the other side of your conference more frequently. The fact that Alabama just came to Columbia for the first time in a decade is ridiculous. You're in the same conference. Why are you not visiting one another more often? Just because you're in opposite divisions? Makes no sense to me. So they've opened the door, and I think they're leaving it up to the conferences. That I believe starting like a year from now, you can get rid of the divisions. Every conference should. Divisions are pointless. Let's make sure we get the two best teams into the conference championships, and let's have these teams play one another more frequently. Instead of every 5 years, or you'll come play in our stadium every 10 years, get rid of the common opponents every year. If there's a rivalry worth keeping, all right, let's have one constant opponent, that's fine, and rotate the rest. So that when you go to school, if you go to South Carolina, in your four-year career, you will play every team at home and on the road. You can do it. We've done it on the show before. We did the simple math. It's very basic. That's what I would want. You go and you have a four-year career, I want you to play in every SEC stadium. Think about that. How ridiculous is that? You could talk to a former Gamecock and say, like, what was it like to play at Alabama? I don't know. I never did. We're in the same conference. We never went there. I think that's silly. So for all the heat that, you know, the decision makers in college sports may take, especially nowadays with name, image, likeness, transport, I think this was a smart move that's long overdue. I never have understood the divisions. A couple of spin-off topics off of this. Because, yes, let's get rid of these divisions. If and when we do, the idea is that there'll still be some constant opponents. I don't like that idea. I want alternating schedules every year. Except, like I said, keep the one rival. Like, make sure Alabama and Auburn play each other every year. That's fine. Right? If you have a real strong rivalry in the conference, keep them. For South Carolina, if you had to play one team every year, personally, as a non-Gamecock fan, I'm saying Georgia. Now, it's probably the last team you want in your schedule every year. You'd love to play a Vanderbilt every year. But just for the meaning, I would want South Carolina, Georgia to stick around personally for me. As a Gamecock fan, you may have a different opinion. In the ACC, if I was a Clemson fan, or I could just tell you as a non-Clemson fan from the outside looking in, for Clemson, I would like constantly on the schedule, keep NC State because there's a little bit of that rivalry brewing, plus just the locale, the geography helps. Florida State as well. And then the third team I would say is Miami. I think it would be interesting to have Miami, as they try to build that program back up, on the schedule every year. But get rid of divisions. Get rid of these constant same opponents. Mix up the schedule. Take the two best teams, and let's do things smarter around here. But as we look at the SEC, while we still have these divisions, I was thinking about this. Which team in the East Division is ready to step up? Because we know Georgia is clearly number one. They're defending national champions. After that, the East Division is wide open for the second straight year. Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, South Carolina, Florida, and sure, let's mention Vanderbilt, though they're not really in the conversation. Which one of those teams is ready to step up and be that second best team? That will be the interesting race in the East. I don't think it'll be for the top of the division. Instead, it'll be who's the next best team behind Georgia. It'll be like when Larry Bird used to be in the three-point shooting contest, and he would show up and say, all right, who's coming in second tonight? That's the same idea. Like, that's the more interesting part. You knew Larry Bird was going to win the three-point contest. The drama was really around who's going to finish in second. Similar in the SEC East. Last year, it was Kentucky. They won 10 games. They were a top 20 team. They surprised a lot of people. Maybe this year, it will be Kentucky once again. We have Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, South Carolina, and Florida. I think Florida is trending up with the coaching change. I think Missouri is trending down. We believe Tennessee and South Carolina are trending up. And Kentucky, because they won 10 games last year and then lost their offensive coordinator, I think their arrow is kind of pointing laterally. I don't know if they're trending up or down. I think they maybe stay around the same because I think they've already kind of hit their ceiling. I don't know how much higher they can go. And I also have some pause for losing their offensive coordinator. That could be a bit of a big change. He was good enough that he got a job in the NFL. It wasn't like he got fired because he didn't know what he was doing. So that's a little bit of a concern for Kentucky. So I put that arrow horizontally. But what's intriguing about this is that in the arms race for second, it really comes down to quarterbacks. And if we take this into a big picture conversation, what do I always say around here? That college football now is about the quarterbacks. And something else I often say is that if you get that first quarterback, that's all you need. And then it leads to another and another and another. You put one guy in the NFL, other quarterbacks, recruits, prospects realize that you are a good or possible destination for them to go play and become an NFL quarterback as well. For Tennessee, they haven't had much to write home about at the quarterback position, at least in the next level, since Peyton Manning 25 years ago. Don't tell me about Eric Ainge, who had a cup of coffee with the Jets. Right, for Kentucky, they had Jared Lorenzen. Right, was he the last one? How many quarterbacks has Kentucky put in, not only into the NFL, but potentially in the first round, like we're hearing with Will Levis? For South Carolina, some mock drafts have Spencer Rattler as a top 10 pick. That's never happened before. If South Carolina does that, for all three of those schools, Kentucky, Tennessee, with Levis, Hooker, and then South Carolina with Spencer Rattler, you're looking at three programs that will be accomplishing something they haven't maybe ever or in a long time and suddenly becoming more intriguing to other quarterbacks. And I have that theory. You get one quarterback, in the case of football, that opens the door to others. Look at Oklahoma. Josh Heupel, oddly enough, now head coach of Tennessee, was that guy. Transferred into Oklahoma, was Bob Stoops' first quarterback, was in the Heisman contention. And after that, that opened the floodgates for Jason White and Sam Bradford. And more recently, obviously, guys like Baker and Kyler Murray. That's probably the better example, just one after another, all winning Heismans, or at least in the competition. Same idea here. For Tennessee, you put Hooker in the first round after the two seasons, or after last year and what he could do this year. And with Josh Heupel, there's a reason why they just got the top quarterback recruit. That's where you want to go. Kentucky, now suddenly it's like, wow, I can go to Kentucky for football and not just basketball. South Carolina, similar. Right? Wow, look at what Spencer Rattler did. That now has become an option for quarterbacks. And then Florida is still Florida. It was a bit of a mess last year, but they always have the potential to have a big-time year and produce NFL talent. And they have a quarterback who could be a first-round draft pick a year from now. The biggest intrigue to me in the SEC, you know Georgia and Alabama, they're the staples. The biggest question to me in the SEC is who's going to finish in second in that East division? Which quarterback is going to step up? Because it won't only have a huge impact on this year, but it could on the future of these programs, like South Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee. And what's most intriguing is that when you look at that East division and you look at the best team led by Stetson Bennett, who just won a national championship, I wonder how many other teams Bennett would actually start on. I don't think he starts over Hooker. I don't think he starts over Spencer Rattler. I don't think he's starting over Will Levis, right? Or Anthony Richardson. Missouri could use a quarterback. They lost theirs. And Vanderbilt could always use a quarterback, maybe. But the team that's best in the division has maybe the least intriguing quarterback. And all the other teams trying to catch up have some very intriguing quarterbacks. Which team will step up this year? I think it's Tennessee will be the second best team. I liked what I saw last year. Like, they finished in third, so it's not a huge climb for them. But I think as impressive as they were a year ago, they'll be even better in year two of Heupel and his offense. And I think Hooker will be in the Heisman conversation. He was really good last year. I think he'll be even better this year. Kentucky may take a step back in the win column by a game or two. Tennessee will move forward by a game or two. I think Georgia wins the East. Tennessee will be the second-best team. But moving forward, as much as I like these conversations, I have no problem with them going away. just like divisions. Let's get rid of divisions so we don't need to talk about this, and instead we'll just be talking about who are the best teams in the SEC in general. Tennessee is still up there. But when it comes to the SEC East, Georgia's number one. I think Tennessee will be number two. But look out for those quarterbacks. That's a very intriguing division for quarterbacks. Coming up, speaking of college football, we had a huge upset over the weekend. What could that mean for college football? What could it mean for other sports? And we do a top 10 list every week, so of course, low-hanging fruit, the 10 biggest upsets in sports history. We'll get to that as well. The Morrow Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, we had one of the biggest upsets in sports over the weekend. What could that mean for other sports like college football? And we'll get to our Tuesday top 10, ranking the 10 biggest upsets in sports history. It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. The Kentucky Derby, of course, is what I'm talking about, which went off Saturday evening and was won by Rich Strike. Is that the horse's name? Rich Strike, 80-1 odds? Nobody even knows. He was added to the field on Friday, goes out there, wins on Saturday, a real ringer situation. And he was not one of these horses. It's not like a Bob Baffert horse. Like, I think it was just regular people that had the horse and bought the horse for $30,000, which may sound like a lot, but in the horsing world is really nothing. I mean, we could pony up $30,000 around here and get a horse in the Kentucky Derby. Not bad. And he surprised everybody. And if you were watching the race, you could also see just the fact of how far back the horse was and found an open lane and went exploding to the victory line. And Rich Strike won as an 80-1 horse in the Derby. Second largest upset in Kentucky Derby history. The only larger one was over 100 years ago. So we really haven't seen something like this in a long, long time. Even if you're not into horse racing, like I only watch, I'm a casual horse racing fan. I watch the Triple Crown races. And sometimes if I go to the track, I obviously watch those races. It's always fun to go to the horse track. But even for me who watches horse racing three times a year, like that was wild on Saturday. That was unfortunate because, again, going back to the bad beats, I don't think anybody bet on Rich Strike. My horse was leading until Rich Strike went on that run. And it's what always happens. If you ever gamble on horse racing, you never want your horse to actually be in the lead because the winner always comes. If you've seen one race, you've seen them all. The horse always comes, usually from the outside, in the home stretch, comes out of nowhere and wins. So if your horse is actually very rarely – I think it actually happened in one of the derbies the last couple years, but very rarely do you get a wire-to-wire finish. Usually the winner comes out of nowhere. They get a late burst, so you don't want your horse to be leading. So I went from thinking like, all right, because by the way, if you listen to the Morrow Midday Show, you know I picked the winner the last 2 years. I thought, oh, here we go, 3 years in a row. I was with my buddies. I told them, here's who we're taking. And one of my friends knows, oh, yeah, he's been good with the Kentucky Derby. So there was a lot of pressure on me, and Rich Strike ruined it. Now everyone always says like, oh, I threw a couple of bucks on Rich Strike. You got to see the ticket, right? You got to be able to prove that you actually bet on him 80-1. $2 would bring back, what, 160? Pretty good. But my uncle was very upset because his name is Rich, and his father-in-law had the same name as the jockey of the horse Rich Strike.
Whoa.
So for people that don't follow horse racing, which is most people, whenever you want to gamble, right, you always look for those connections. Like, oh, the horse has the same name as me. And then on top of that, the jockey has the same name as my father-in-law. I mean, this is a sign. And he didn't bet on Rich Strike.
Mm.
Because, of course, nobody actually expected Rich Strike. He's 80-1. You're thinking, nah, this guy, it's just a waste of money. And then, of course, he wins. And my uncle, Rich, was kicking himself over not actually betting Rich Strike on Saturday.
We should have known Rich Strike was going to win, though, Luke. I don't know if you saw the shot of all the horses walking out, you know, getting prepared. He was the absolute wildest one. He was biting other horses. You know, he was going crazy, just let me out of here type thing. As soon as even my mom pointed it out, my mom goes, what horse is that? And nobody had a clue. And then, boom, comes, you know, one of the greatest comebacks in history. It was unbelievable. But he was biting people.
Yeah.
He was biting other horses, like an untrained horse. It wasn't a Bob Baffert horse. But, I mean, it was unbelievable to watch.
Yeah. Listen, Rich, act like you've been there before. He wins the race. He's going around biting other horses. That was more entertaining than the race.
It was. He was so fired up.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe it.
And the guy on the other horse is, like, punching him. He's a Kentucky Derby winner. The guy's trying to get him off his horse. And they cut away eventually. I'm surprised they showed it as long as they did on the TV coverage. And then they cut away to, like, a replay or something. We had more fun laughing at that moment than actually watching the race. He was going wild afterwards, celebrating.
I think he remembered that guy. I think the guy was coming through the stables and kind of, like, you know, grabbed him and said, tighten up. And so he went and found
That's right.
The guy on the horse and then just tried to bite his arm off.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah, I was trying to get his revenge. So congratulations to Rich Reck. Now, here's the question. 80-1 odds, he won the Derby yesterday. Before I get to what this could mean for college football, at least in the mind of one college football coach, Trent, let me read off these options. You tell me what is the most likely.
Ooh.
These are other events with the same odds, 80-1.
Awesome.
USA wins the World Cup.
Oh.
The Miami Marlins win the World Series this year. Texas wins the College Football National Championship. Sergio Garcia wins the PGA Championship. The Seahawks win the Super Bowl. Josh Hader wins the Cy Young this year. Or Lamar Jackson is the NFL's leading rusher. Those all have the same odds as Rich Strike. If you had a bet on one of them, what do you think would be the most likely?
You know, Luke, my heart would tell me, but you never gamble with your heart. That's the most important thing. My heart would tell me go with, Team USA to win the World Cup, win the Soccer Lombardi. I would love for that to happen to bring it back home. It is coming home this summer, Luke, or this fall, excuse me. But I'd probably have to say, with all those options, it's got to be Texas, right? With the influx of talent and everything that they have. They got the Quinn Ewers, got the wide receiver from Alabama. They got, Bijan Robinson in the backfield. He's an incredibly talented running back. So I would probably, out of all those options, the Marlins aren't winning anything. We know that. And the Seahawks, I'll be surprised if they win four games next season. So I'd go with Texas, Luke.
Interesting. So are you telling me that Texas is back?
You know, when Sam Ehlinger said that, I really got turned off by Texas and their whole brand, Luke. But I don't know. I mean, we've been kind of waiting for, it seems like, for the last 10 years to see if Texas will go on a run. Like, and it just hasn't happened. So could it be the year? Potentially. But if Arch Manning comes in there, I mean, it's all over but the crying, Luke.
That's true. Now, if I had to choose, I like the last two, which are kind of more like prop bets. Lamar Jackson to lead the league in rushing. Now, it sounds incredibly unlikely. He's a quarterback, right? I don't know if a quarterback has ever led the league in rushing. You have to go back a pretty far way, I would imagine. But Lamar, especially now without Hollywood Brown, they don't have a lot of throwing targets to throw to. And when it came to rushing, he had 1,200 yards in 2019.
Whew.
That was in 15 games. So in 17 games, if he gets up to, say, 1,300, could that be enough to lead the league in rushing this year? We know rushing yard totals kind of going down. You have split backfields. You're not running it as often. I know he just got injured last year. You don't want to have him running around and get injured again. It's his contract year, so that could go one of two ways. Either he's going to try to protect himself. He doesn't want to get injured in a contract year. Or he's going to want to really put on a show to make even more money and make even more plays. It may sound crazy, like, no way could a quarterback lead the league in rushing. But if there is one, I mean, Lamar Jackson, if he goes for over 1,200 yards like he did 2 years ago, maybe that's enough to lead the league in rushing. I don't know.
Depends on, I feel like, Derrick Henry's health, right? Because he's a guy that goes over 1,500, it seems like, every year if he plays every single game. And I'm not sure how many rushing yards Jonathan Taylor had, but you'd have to assume that he's going to, have a similar season to what he had last year.
It's a good point. So if you look up last year, Jonathan Taylor did lead the league with 1,800, which is wild. But then next, second, is Nick Chubb at 1,259. Now, Derrick Henry was obviously injured last year. But that's kind of part of the equation is running backs usually get hurt. They don't play a full year, a lot of them.
That's intriguing.
So, Nick Chubb, 1,259, 17-game season. If Lamar plays like he did in 2019, he's right around that total, probably even better. So now you're kind of betting on nobody having a year like Jonathan Taylor did last year. A couple of running backs maybe getting banged up. Lamar playing like he did in 2019. It's a possibility. Maybe worth a little 80-1 flyer. And the other one I do like, which maybe is more reasonable, is Josh Hader winning the Cy Young. He's the reliever for the Milwaukee Brewers. The Brewers should win that division, so he'll be on a good team. And right now, he has not allowed a run in 11 appearances so far. 11 appearances, he's 11 for 11 in saves, no runs. He's allowed two hits in 11 appearances and has 16 strikeouts. I think, I believe it was Cy Young. Yeah, Josh Hader is a reliever. Now I'm confusing myself because it seems like those odds are way too high. And now I'm thinking, was it actually MVP that I misread? No, but I believe it was just simply Cy Young. I think that's a pretty safe bet, too. Josh Hader to potentially win the Cy Young this year as the closer of the Brewers. Usually it goes to starters, of course. I believe Mariano once won the Cy Young, if I remember correctly, I think. But if there's a reliever that could do it, it could be Hader. Now, coming up, the final part of this conversation, we'll get to our top 10 later on this afternoon to rank the top 10 biggest upsets. But there was one college football coach who took this Kentucky Derby surprise and tried to apply it to college football, and I think it's a mistake, and we'll get to that next. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Wrapping up hour one of the Morrow Midday Show at Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Last segment talking about the big surprise at the Kentucky Derby with Rich Strike winning as an 80-1 underdog in that race. Second largest underdog to ever win the Kentucky Derby. That led to Mike Leach tweeting out Saturday night that the horse winning the Kentucky Derby today is a good example of why an expanded college football playoff is needed. That horse hadn't won all the races leading up, but it got its chance, and that's what happened. No, I think that's a bad trying to go from point A to point B. I don't think that quite fits or works. Don't use this Kentucky Derby surprise, the largest upset we've had in over 100 years, as a reason to believe we should expand the college football playoff. Leach is also, by the way, I remember a couple years ago talking about when he was campaigning to have a 64-team playoff in college football. Part of it may be because Leach would need such a large playoff field to actually get there, but also it's just a crazy idea. And we go through this in March Madness every year. St. Peter's goes on a run, and everybody says, this is why we need to expand college football. Not all sports are the same. Just because something happens in one sport doesn't mean it can happen in another. Don't even try to draw the parallels. And if you're pointing to the fact that, as Mike Leach said, this horse hadn't won all the races leading up, but he got his chance, and that's what happened. Well, then that's only rendering the regular season even more pointless. If you're going to put in a team in there that is an 80-1 long shot, just to give them, hey, you never know what could happen. That's not crowning a true champion, which is the argument about March Madness. That as fun as it is, it's not the best way to actually crown a champion. And if I've said it once, I've said it a million times, and I actually have on the Morrow Midday Show, I think college football does the best in crowning a true champion. We have never come away once saying, I don't think they were the best team in college football. We've had a legitimate champion every year. In the NBA, usually injuries play a role. Right? In the NFL, sometimes, same idea. It's the healthiest team or the hottest team. The Giants, when they won the Super Bowl, weren't truly the best team that year. March Madness, every year you can make a debate like, they were just the hottest team. They weren't the best. But college football, we truly crown a real champion, and that's what I like. Stop taking other sports examples and trying to compare it to yours. It doesn't work that way. Hour two next.